Good afternoon, everyone. One of these days, I'm just going to say good morning, Vietnam, for kicks, but that's not today. Welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Speaking of Vietnam, you're wearing your Optimus Prime shirt, which I've...
Right. He always goes for the shirt. The shirt analysis has become the obligatory opening.
I have so little imagination that I just literally talk about the first thing I see, which is usually a shirt.
Okay. Well, I want to be clear that this refers to the older Transformers and not the terrible Michael Bay new ones.
Did you see Bumblebee?
I didn't.
It's not bad. It's worth watching if you're an old school Transformers fan.
Okay. I'll get on that right away.
I digress. Okay. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new biopic, Dolomite Is My Name. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including the Marvel debate, part 12. It's hard to say if there's anyone left who hasn't shared their point of view, but we'll share ours. And then Vince will reveal his top five of 1999 list. There are still a lot of movies that actually haven't made anyone's lists yet. And we'll
have
see.
You revealed your list?
No, mine. I'm next week.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We'll see if Vince scores any points for originality.
I have a good feeling I will, sir.
All right.
1999 was an original year.
All right. We will find out shortly. First, though, China. Hollywood is becoming more and more dependent on Chinese revenue. But what is it costing Hollywood? And indeed, this controversy sort of came up again with a children's animated film called Abominable, which is about a little girl who tries to return the Yeti to his home, which you think, not a lot of controversy there, but there's 3 seconds of a map that flashes across the screen. It is of the eastern coastline of Asia, where it shows the dreaded 9-dot line, which is on Chinese maps. They show this 9-dot line, which just basically carves out a big portion of the South China Sea, where China is basically saying, we're in charge of this portion of the ocean. And that has gotten...
That's a big no-no. Like, that is
It is
huge.
A big no-no, yeah.
It's... Just kidding, I'd never heard of the 9-point line, ever.
No, but I mean, you're right. It is sort of a big deal, but I mean, it's sort of like a wink-wink, nudge-nudge to the fact that Hollywood and China is, you know, working so closely, and it has a lot to do with China will soon be the number one movie market in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts?
it's less something that I have like an opinion on. It's more just interesting, right? It's interesting how they will deal with that, right? Obviously, China is kind of using that leverage to like put themselves in a favorable position in, you know, America. But it's like, the same time, I mean, I think what they're trying to imply is that it's going to get more blatant. Like right now it's 9 points on a line or whatever, or on a map.
Yeah.
But it might get more blatant. So I think it's interesting what will happen, right?
Well, I mean, you can make the argument it is even actually more blatant than now when you have, you know, actually the thing with Abominable is that it was a Chinese co-production. It was a Shanghai animation studio working with DreamWorks. So they're already sort of like in the production process, and Paramount's been funding a lot of its movies lately with Chinese money.
Right, featuring like China in a predominant kind of role. Like it used The Martian as an example, like, you know, the Chinese kind of step in and save the day kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, The Great Wall, obviously, is kind of just a more obvious example of like...
Right.
We need to kind of collaborate on a big budget movie.
The Great Wall is kind of a unique case. You know, it walks right up to the line of... Actually, no, because China is like one of the last sort of markets where like star power matters. And if you put Matt Damon in a movie, there's a lot of talk about like the whole white savior complex thing with having Matt Damon in medieval China helping them save the world from... monsters. Yeah. I don't think it's ever explained in the movie where the monsters come from.
But it's like, so what? Like, American movies have always been, like, kind of sleazy in that way themselves. So it's like, yeah. Can you blame China for doing that? And also, it's
no,
like,
it's...
right, look at American Sniper. It's like, that is the film equivalent of the 9-point map kind of move, right? It's so blatantly pro-American that it's hard to be like upset about, ooh, will they infringe on the American kind of cinema freedom? It's like, whatever, man. It's already been infringed on. It's already kind of something totally disingenuous anyway. So
I don't disagree with that argument. There is the flip side of it, though, with like Chinese censorship. And there's actually examples of Bohemian Rhapsody, mm-hmm. Which was censored for China, you know, to tone down, you know, Freddie Mercury's sexuality. Freddie Mercury was identified as gay. And I mean, I have a lot of problems with that movie that have a lot to do with the fact that it really works hard to deal with Freddie Mercury's sexuality while not dealing with it.
Yeah.
But I mean, so China's coming in like, no, it's still too gay. And then the same thing with a scene in Avengers Endgame where there's a scene where there's a man who's talking about having gone on a date with another man. And that's a bridge too far for China, too. And it's like, you know, yeah, you're trying to make some sort of social commentary with these movies. And then when they go to China, social commentary goes out the window because you have to have that Chinese bank. And, you know, how much is that worth to you?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, China is famously for self-censoring their movies, even, this, you know, censoring their own talent. Li Bangbang went missing for like 2 months, like famous, actually almost famous in North America, too, because she was in movies like The Meg, and I think she was in Great Wall, too. But she like was missing for 2 months because she was like stiffing China on taxes.
But it's like, what does them censoring Bohemian Rhapsody have to do with anything? It's like, isn't that their prerogative to do that in their own country? Like, what does that have to do with their collaboration with American studios?
Well, I think, you know, Hollywood makes a big deal out of, you know, if the American government talks about like censorship, like you're talking about like the good old days of like the you know, the motion picture board and like you can't have too much sex or violence or anything like that. You know, there was an outcry, you know, going back to even like the 70s when Congress was talking about, you know, having to have a family hour on TV, which, you know, would automatically take out, you know, edgy shows, edgy for the time, like All in the Family. And there was a huge backlash about that. And Hollywood has had that history of like, you try to stifle our expression, we punch back. And now it's going to China and there's no punchback. And in fact, they're actually actively helping the censorship so that they can, you know, it's purely about capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's
business as usual. Business in Hollywood. As usual. Cool.
But, you know, Hollywood used to, you know, stand for, you know, it's always been a business naturally, but, you know, being the rebellious sort of showbiz was also part of the message too. And now they're sort of willfully selling that out because China is now such a key market.
Interesting.
I mean, it's, you know, it depends how you look at it, right?
Right.
It's hard enough, and, you know, we'll get into this for a second, that, you know, only these big movies are able to, like, sort of make money in the theaters now. And now we're kind of, like, crap. Since this is, like, the culture people engage with at the cinema now, when they craft that for an audience for a distribution model that, you know, encourages censorship, you know, you're definitely focusing things more on the business and less about the show.
Right. Yes.
And it's only a matter of time too before it's like, well, and actually it is happening already when you think about like the Pirates of the Caribbean movies or like something like Warcraft, where these movies are successful in the Transformers movies too, massively successful in China, not so much successful in the United States, but they keep getting greenlit because they make the bank worldwide, a lot of that in China. And so at what point do we maybe start see Hollywood studios sort of like making things with China in mind? And it, right. it could be argued they already are.
Right. I won't be seeing those particular films, but I really wish you luck with, you know, that whole debacle.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure what role I can play in it. So let's get right into this week 18 of the Is the Marvel Cinematic Universe Cinema controversy. I think since we talked about this last month, Peter and I, we've gotten not just Martin Scorsese and Jennifer Aniston, we've gotten Francis Ford Coppola, we've gotten Ken Loach, and even Disney CEO Bob Iger has gotten into it. I'll get into your points of view in a minute, but the Francis Ford Coppola one, where he said that, he said Scorsese was kind when he said that it wasn't cinema. He didn't say it was despicable, which is what I would have said.
Right.
Despicable's kind of harsh.
Well, you have to look at the man who's saying it. This is a man who's made like five of the greatest American movies of all time. Like, his perspective is obviously going to be different than the rest of you.
Despicable, though.
Yeah. What is wrong with that?
Well, despicable that, you know, they have no value at all. The mere fact that we're making them is a disgrace to...
Correct. Right. Well said, sir.
I didn't say it. First of all, I didn't say it. I'm paraphrasing or interpreting Francis Ford Coppola, but it just seems like, I mean, both sides of this are like really on fire. Like, they're really fired up about it. And I just wish, like, if you don't want to see the Marvel movies, that's cool. Don't see them.
Yeah, it's hard not to, though.
It's hard not to.
And
I know.
It's hard when you are trying to be in this business. And now it's being influenced in a negative way by this stuff.
There's no doubt about it that the influence is, and I mean, the influence has kind of largely blown up. Like, nobody's talking about it. You know, the multi-movie universe in the Marvel mold. Like, everyone who's tried that has failed at it spectacularly. But I think what you're getting at, and I think what Martin Scorsese was trying to get at, and he's sort of like refined his comment several times,
right?
Because he keeps getting asked about it. But, you know, is that, you know, there has to be a place in the cinema world for smaller movies, medium movies, and that is being crowded out. And yes, it is a problem when something like The Avengers opens and you have a 6-screen movie theater and 4 of them are showing The Avengers. Like, how many times, you know, again, that falls into the business. And I would rather the debate now go to how do we engage more people into checking out those movies in the theater? How do we make more room in the theater? Because, again, it's purely about the naked capitalism
of
it.
They
can fill four
theaters
with Avengers audiences.
That I don't think will ever be answered, and I don't think anyone is interested in answering that. I think they're only interested in making these properties bigger.
Sure.
So it's like, yeah, it's a very idealistic view, but sadly, it's like, yeah, how do you bring attention to those films? I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's also like, you know.
But I think if someone also made this point that the Scorsese and Coppola point of view, it's not new. And indeed, you know, you can go back to, you know, the early 80s.
Oh, come on, man. You're going to compare the early 80s to what is happening right now with $300 bazillion and, like, every single major star starring in this stuff. It's not even close, man. Like, it's totally
the scale is different.
Right.
But Scorsese and Coppola both look down their nose at Spielberg and Lucas for selling out and going and doing stuff like Star Wars and Raiders and E.T., that, you know, they had that feeling then, too.
No, I don't think so, man. I don't think he was like, this is despicable. Like, show me that quote and show me that interview or show me that thing, man.
I don't think Coppola said despicable, but...
Okay, well, I don't think they felt nearly as much hostility for those properties as they do for what is currently happening. And Martin Scorsese is just saying, like, mm-hmm. it's a different kind of cinema now. It's equivalent to going to a theme park. That's what you are going to when you go see these films. Yeah. I'm sorry that you get teary-eyed when people snap their fingers and you watch your, like, hero disappear. But that does not mean that it is cinema. That just means you had an emotional reaction to something that was silly and goofy. So there's also a problem with quality as well. It's like, a lot of people are seeing this on like a huge scale, but they're also dumb movies as well.
Well, quality is subjective. I think that...
Right. So the subject saying this is Martin Scorsese and Francis Coppola, to get back to it. And they are infinitely more qualified than people like Robert Downey Jr. or whoever else is coming to the defense of Marvel. People like James Gunn or whatever. It's like...
Well, like Robert Downey Jr.'s next movie is Doolittle. If you've seen that trailer, he's not exactly the greatest arbiter of quality.
Right.
But I think that, I mean, it goes both ways. Like, there have been like some over the top stuff said about like Scorsese and Coppola about this. And there has to be a way to find an equilibrium again, because I remember leaving the first Avengers in 2012 and I was like walking out of the theater behind somebody and he was like, "That's the greatest movie I'll ever see." And I was like, "That's the greatest movie I'll ever..." Like, I enjoyed the Avengers, but I don't think it's the greatest movie I will ever see.
Right.
So, you know...
That's probably, like, a popular opinion, actually. Like,
I don't doubt it.
I work at a movie store. I'm on the front lines of what people in this city... What people in this city want in terms of movies, man. And it is not Ingmar Bergman, I'm telling you. Okay? So... But continue.
He's on the front lines. Okay. No, but you're right.
It's kind of what it is now, man. It's like...
But, I mean, you're right. It does sort of feel like that in a way, and everyone has gone to their corner, and I think I think it's pointless to keep having the debate.
No, but I think the debate has just started, man. Like,
I
was the brunt of the joke, like, even 3 years ago on this program. It's like, oh, Vince and his Marvel movies or whatever. Now you have some serious directors, like, chiming in, and now you know it's a serious. Now it's not a laughing matter. You've got some, like, serious heavyweights saying, like, standing in my corner saying the same thing.
I think I did hear Scorsese talk about wanting to back you up, but...
Okay, whatever, vice versa, whatever.
But no, I mean, what I want to say is that the debate is over about, you know, who thinks it's cinema, who doesn't think it's cinema. I think that's a pointless debate, that's like a scorched earth debate. And I think what we want to have is, like, how do you make room in the cinema for all types of movies? Because it is all the big, like, the Dolomite Is My Name, which we're reviewing this week, that should have been like a dunk for, you know, seeing movies in theaters. And actually, you know, maybe there's a bit of a commentary in it, given the film's subject matter, that, you know, there's no room in the cinema for a movie about Ruby Moore. But it's also, I think the debate needs to be reframed that, you know, there should be room in the cinema for all movies and not just about how the Avengers... are popular, because they are popular, and, you know, that's not going to change until one of those movies does really, really badly, box office wise, which may never happen. I don't know.
Didn't Dark Phoenix already, like, underperform? Like, didn't it already bomb?
Well, you're right, and I mean that means we won't see an X-Men movie for a while. But
okay, but there's still the Marvel properties. There's still the formula they're churning out with the same thing, man. It's like, yeah, you won't see an X-Men, but you will see somebody else in a different costume doing the same thing.
Yeah, so, there's already like 3 more years of Marvel movies scheduled.
Right, so just because that one's bombed doesn't mean they will, like, get the message and stop making...
No, but what I mean is that, you know, these things come in waves. Like, superhero movies used to be, like, nothing. They used to be... You know,
I don't know.
Crappy, like, you know, if you could think back to like Batman and Robin, that used to be the conventional thought of what a superhero movie looked like, and things have changed. And, you know, these things come in waves.
They've changed for the worse, though, is the point I'm making. Like,
worse than Batman and Robin?
Those were like good kind of progressions or whatever. not Batman and Robin specifically, but I am saying, like, there was a time when cinema had integrity at that time or whatever. And I don't know, man.
I think we'll have to have a debate about whether 1997 had cinema integrity, but that's a debate we'll have to have another time.
Why 1997?
Well, that's when Batman and Robin came out.
So?
All right,
never. What does that have to do with the whole year?
Get your top five for 1999
okay.
ready.
I've got it.
We're going to take a break and then come right back with that. So you're listening to End Credits on CFRU.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise. And suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast.
I want to tell you my secret now.
Dreams? While you're awake? Dead people like in graves and coffins?
Walking around like regular people. They don't see each other. They only see what they want to see. They don't know they're dead.
How often do you see them?
All the time.
So that was a scene from The Sixth Sense, and it was on Candace's list last week, so we'll see if it's on Vince's list this week. So let's start with your number five.
Well, my number five is, in fact, The Sixth Sense. The great M. Night Shyamalan masterpiece. And first, I want to preface, okay, like, why are we talking about 1999 mm-hmm. and the best movies of 1999? Did we just, like, pull that year out of our ear? I don't think so. Was it just a coincidence that all these people had just original ideas? I don't think so either. I think there was a culture of originality and a culture of freedom and artistic expression at these studios, the big studios mm-hmm. at the time, that resulted in such great cinema. Or maybe everyone thought the year or the world was going to end the following year. I don't know. But
you could be right about that. But
I just want to like, there's a reason we're talking about this year. And I don't think it's a coincidence, is what I'm saying. But anyway.
I would point out that the years leading up to 1999 were very similar to where we are now. There was a lot of big budget franchise pictures that ended up bombing. But I'll digress to get into your list there.
Where were the big franchises?
Like Godzilla.
Sphere. But that was one movie, so how was that a franchise?
Well, they wanted it to be a franchise. It ends with a cliffhanger.
Right. So I would say it's not a franchise by definition. So, right. Number five is, in fact, M. Night Shyamalan's movie. And, you know, the interesting lead up to The Sixth Sense actually involves his previous two efforts, which were kind of panned and totally bombed. And he was kind of playing it safe as a filmmaker, I think, mm-hmm. About, you know, more autobiographical stuff about a young Indian man kind of looking for spirituality kind of stuff. And it just didn't work for him. It just wasn't what he had in his soul. And he came out with this script, The Sixth Sense. He was like, I'm going to sell a script for $1 million. And he ended up doing it. And it was a fantastic movie. And you know what? I think the following, like, 3 or 4 years were actually very good for M. Night Shyamalan, and I still have a tremendous amount of respect for him for making that movie. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Number four?
Number four is actually the Paul Thomas Anderson masterpiece, Magnolia.
Ooh, I don't think Magnolia's made anyone's list yet.
Okay. Well, it was actually mentioned by Ingmar Bergman, the great Swedish director, as an example of what American cinema can do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that P.T. Anderson, I think, just as a result of Boogie Nights and maybe some other stuff, think he was, you know, incredibly influenced by Scorsese. But he always said that he was very, very influenced by Robert Altman. And Magnolia is like the Robert Altman kind of homage, I guess, specifically Shortcuts, which kind of, you know, involves, a lot of stories, kind of sub-stories and whatever, and they all kind of connect in the end, but I feel like it was less gimmicky than like stuff like Pulp Fiction, where it's like, ooh, look at how clever I am, how everything kind of ties together neatly at the end. This was more kind of loosely, they were kind of loosely kind of related. So just an absolute masterpiece back when, you know, again, P.T. Anderson was coming off of Boogie Nights, and they were like, you can do whatever you want, and I think he should be respected for choosing to do that as, like, his carte blanche.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
You want to go to your number three?
Yeah. Number three is the Stanley Kubrick masterpiece, Eyes Wide Shut, actually.
Yeah, Tim's number one.
Really? Yeah, I can definitely see that. This movie, I think, has kind of been swept under the rug in terms of Stanley Kubrick's filmography. A lot of people were kind of not sure how to interpret it. But I just think the kind of odyssey that Tom Cruise goes on in this movie, you know, through New York and then through these kind of seedy clubs and whatever, is just so Kubrick-like, and it's just so mysterious and haunting and interesting.
It's weird because Kubrick never left England, so they had to redress London as New York. So, I mean, that adds to the haunting quality because it's set in New York, but it doesn't look right.
Right.
So it's a little bizarre that way.
Right. I think if Kubrick was still around today, he would be like a huge, huge fan of P.T. Anderson. I think P.T. Anderson has a lot of like Kubrick influence in his films as well. Anyway, number two is
number two.
Film that was rife with conflict all throughout, featuring David O. Russell and George Clooney.
Oh yeah,
it is of course Three Kings, the movie set in the Gulf War, featuring kind of a zany cast of troops kind of going after this Iraqi bullion that they're kind of getting. They're taking advantage of the situation, the kind of confusion after the Gulf War, and they kind of go off on their own. It's a very, very unrealistic in terms of like military kind of protocol, but it's such an amazing kind of movie, and it's very much like, you know, those kind of 70s, like Clint Eastwood kind of man on a mission kind of, you know, to hell with the military, we're going for our own kind of thing, kind of movies.
And, you know, speaking of Altman and the 70s, it's also got a lot in common with MASH.
Right.
In terms of, like, being, like, it's set in, like, a military structure, but it's all very anarchic and...
Yes.
Very cynical.
You've got Ice Cube, and then you've got Spike Jonze and George Clooney. Just this wonderful, like, mixture of these fantastic actors.
Yeah.
Of course, George Clooney and David O. Russell got into some serious like conflict on the set. I think they actually like traded blows at one point.
They haven't worked together since,
but they did make a masterpiece. So at least there's that. It's not like, you know, Dr. Moreau where everyone hated each other and then the movie also sucked on top of that. It's like at least they made a great, great movie.
Well, there was a great documentary out of Dr. Moreau, though.
Right. David O. Russell, never known for being like a super courteous, kind guy on his sets.
No.
George Clooney, kind of.
I wonder if he's chilled over the years.
Yeah.
You don't really hear about that. Like,
maybe there was that incident on I Heart Huckabees, but maybe he chilled since then.
Well, I think that was the last time he was like accused of like stirring it up. It was I Heart Huckabees, because, you know, when you think about his recent stuff, you know, Silver Linings Playbook, and, you know, what was the one with Jennifer Lawrence invents the miracle mop?
Yeah, Joy.
So, like, you don't really hear a lot of stuff about David O. Russell like trying to punch out Bradley Cooper.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
So I'm glad someone, because I was thinking that Three Kings might make my list. It still might, but it is like a really unique movie. Like, we're talking about an era like pre 9/11 where there aren't a lot of like war movies, not a lot of military movies, at least not like
certainly movies that show like American troops being bad kind of thing.
Yeah,
like Buffalo Soldiers was kind of the next kind of like companion piece, I would say, to Three Kings, and that was totally like snuffed out because
it had been like there were still war movies, but they were like Saving Private Ryan, where it was like with reverence for the soldier and for American.
And I do think they redeem themselves at the end of this. They decide to give the gold bullion to the poor Iraqis kind of fleeing, so it does kind of redeem them, but it doesn't do it in a cheap kind of overly sentimental way.
Yeah, because they basically give them the gold so that they don't get court-martialed. It works. It's like the happy ending, but because it's not saccharine, it's perfectly justified. And when you're thinking about like how the main characters are basically, you know, out to enhance themselves, and it stays true to that. So you get the happy ending and nobody learns anything, which is perfect.
Right. Yes. I think, it was one of those movies. I think if it was any other year, it would have been nominated for some Oscars. But because 1999 was such a strong year, and unfortunately didn't get that.
I agree. All right. Let's get to number one.
Yes. So my number one is a movie that it would be hard for me to like sit here and articulate how much this number one movie has influenced me. Not just movies in 1999, but like... everything changed after I saw this movie. My writing changed. The way I saw cinema changed. And
it's Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace.
Yes. Commercial break, sir. Ewan McGregor. Never was another one like it. No. The movie is Spike Jonze' masterpiece, Being John Malkovich.
Ah.
And when I think about cinema, when I think about that word, that movies like Being John Malkovich are what I think about. People who had a bold, daring, original idea, and they had a great genius director that could execute it in a bold, daring, and original way. And it said something interesting and unique and original. And the fact that John Malkovich actually participated in this is something like a cinematic miracle. It's so, and of course, you were involved with my short film, which was about Morgan Spurlock.
Mm-hmm.
If
you're about to compare me to John Malkovich, I accept the compliment.
I mean, your acting abilities, yes. Physically, perhaps not, but like your acting abilities,
enough.
Yes. But no, we unfortunately couldn't get the real Morgan Spurlock, but like I always think about how much funnier it would have been if we had gotten him. But the whole thing ties together when John Cusack is kind of introduced as this puppeteer, and he's a failing puppeteer, and that is what he's passionate and he loves, and he uses the whole shtick of being John Malkovich to kind of pursue his career as a puppeteer. And I thought that was like absolutely brilliant. That's where the actual genius of that concept was.
Mm-hmm.
Like that concept alone could have been, you know, something really, really funny for 90 minutes, but they like took, they didn't stick. It wasn't enough to just have a portal into being John Malkovich. They had to kind of put this beautiful kind of statement about artists and artistry, I guess. And it's also just a very funny, entertaining movie.
And it's like two people you don't really hear from a lot anymore, like Charlie Kaufman and John Cusack.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, that's like that occurred to me after
John
Tim.
Cusack, yeah, coming off of, you know, Gross Point Blank. He was kind of big in the late 90s.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he still had a long road to go. Like High Fidelity was, I think, 2000.
Right.
You know, and getting into things like... I forget what was the war movie he was in where he's like the
Thin Red Line. Yes.
No. There was one where he's like a weapons dealer in like Eastern
Inc.
Yeah. I mean, that was sort of like the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
Not that I hope it's the end for John Q. I hope he makes a comeback, but it seems like he's more known now for his Twitter tirades than any substantive cinematic contributions, which is stupid. And I don't know what last Charlie Kaufman movie I saw was Schenectady, New York.
Last one I saw was the animated one that he did. It was Anomalisa.
Oh, that's right.
And I believe he's doing something now as well for for streaming or something. I don't know, but
Everybody's doing something for streaming.
Spike Jones randomly just won an Oscar for like Her many years later.
Yeah,
and the man obviously knows good screenplays when he sees them. Like, yeah, obviously. So
cool Beastie Boys videos too.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to start somewhere. And I think that's probably the message of Dolomite Is My Name, but we'll review that in a minute. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. The only time she gets dressed in black, take a flight, baby, count you down. On your way off without a sound, black moon rising above the clouds, you're the sunshine.
Want this thing to be raw. Tell it like it is on the streets.
Yeah, lots of pimps and whores and cussing. And kung fu and karate. Brothers love all that kung fu and karate.
Do you know karate?
No, but I'm a fast learner. I can learn how to chop me a mother. Hiya! Hiya! Huh! Hiya! You know what we should have? An all-girl kung fu army.
You know, there's plenty of story opportunity, Rudy. Across this nation, inner cities are being plagued by violent crime. I feel the government hasn't stepped up.
That's it. It's Whitey's fault. The mayor's corrupt and there's an exorcism.
God damn it, an exorcism?
Yeah, you know all that whole mother in hell.
I don't know how that fits into our urban motif.
I don't know either, but it sounds great. That was a clip from Dolomite Is My Name. It's a new film from Craig Brewster, and it stars Eddie Murphy, Keegan-Michael Key, Mike Epps, Craig Robinson, Titus Burgess, Divine Joy Randolph, and Wesley Snipes. And we were talking before we recorded that we were both unfamiliar with Dolomite. I think I heard the name, but I don't think I ever really... like knew anything about Dolomite. It's one of those names that, you know, maybe you're reading like something about black cinema in the 70s and it's like, well, it's along the lines of Dolomite, and it's like, oh, Dolomite, moving on. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's interesting. This story was interesting, and I think there's I saw the comparison, but while watching it I was thinking a lot about Ed Wood.
Yeah. Like this whole like story has kind of been done before, but like,
sure, yeah.
It's again, it's the classic quote by Roger Ebert. It's not what it's about; it's how it's about it.
Right.
And this one is like actually fantastic. You know what I mean? Like it's like the disaster artist kind of. There's a bit of you know, there's a movie in 2003 called Badass about.
I was thinking about Badass too. Yeah.
Mario Van Peebles kind of like playing his father during the making of Sweet Badass Song or something.
It's Sweet Badass Song. Yeah.
Sorry.
But it's very much of that mold too.
Right. And what they are kind of these kind of tough, very industrious, street smart kind of guys getting thrown into this kind of neat and proper and
throwing
standardized
themselves.
Way of being on a film set, and kind of the things, the comedy that kind of comes from people who don't know how to make movies making movies. But this one had like a wonderful kind of lead up to it, right? It was like very much from the perspective of kind of a black man during that era, right? They go see Eddie Murphy, who is so like great in this. He will 100% get nominated for Best Actor for this movie. Like, he's so good in this. And they go see the front page, him and his buddies at the cinema, the Billy Wilder movie. And they're like, you know, this just doesn't, for lack of a better way of saying it, doesn't resonate with, you know, like
with people
us.
Like them. Yeah. And by that, you know, people, like, they mean black people, obviously. They see it with like pretty much an all white audience and who's yucking it up. And
Eddie Murphy, previous to this, had this kind of character he had developed in these comedy clubs, right? He was doing this kind of mixture of this like beat poetry and almost like drag kind of thing. It was like this Very interesting character that he was doing in nightclubs.
Which is probably taken from Dolomite.
Right. And then off the strength of that, they decide, like, you know, he's making some money from the records, and they decide we need to get into the Dolomite. We need to get into the movie business, yeah. Right? I want to go bigger.
Right.
And, you know, Eddie Murphy is just like, this is just such a good performance by him. Probably the best thing that, like, I've seen him do. It's just, he's so funny, and yeah. There was a moment too where at the end of the film, they're struggling to find a distributor,
mm-hmm.
and Eddie Murphy is kind of like, I thought this film was going to, like, change everything for me.
Yeah.
And I'm experiencing the exact same thing right now with this short film, and I really, really identified with what was happening, and it's like, that is cinema, you know what I mean? Somebody who does not look like me, sound like me, or think like me, but I can really identify with the struggle he's having with this film.
Yeah. There's something... first of all, like, Eddie Murphy is great. I think he hasn't been on screen a lot in the last, let's say, like, 7 or 8 years. Like, he's done a lot of voiceover stuff, but, you know, in terms of his live action presence, he has not been on screen a lot. I think that helps. I think that, like, going into this movie and, like, remembering Eddie Murphy was not just, like, a talent or a guy we've seen in movies, but was, like, a genuinely outstanding comedic talent who, you know, actually made a niche for himself in the 80s when you're talking about Beverly Hills Cop or Coming to America or whatever. So, I mean, it's, like, that portion of rediscovered a great talent. And I think if Eddie Murphy gets an Oscar nomination, Wesley Snipes should also get an Oscar nomination.
I was going to say, this might sound inflammatory, but I think Wesley Snipes should get nominated. He's playing probably the only guy, like yeah. a real actor, yes. but the only guy who is actually, like, Eddie Murphy's character kind of just happens to stumble upon him at a strip club, approaches yeah. him about, hey, do you want to be in my film? And he's like, I was directed by Roman Polanski, even though he was yeah. like, had like a 20-second
because bit. He was the elevator operator in Rosemary's Baby.
Right. So he's got like a huge ego through the whole thing. And he actually directs the film.
Yeah, that's how they get him to be in the film is right. that they offer him the director's spot. And of course, he perks up because everyone wants to be a director.
And you know, of course, the budget on it is like nothing. So Wesley Snipes is like, who are these DPs?
Yeah.
He's like, a what? He's a director of photography. It's just like the kind of banter between Eddie Murphy and Wesley Snipes is good.
It's not the lines. It's not, well, not just like he delivers the lines well, but like while they're shooting the movie, it cuts right. to him so many times and he cannot believe what right. is going on his set.
And he's kind of got a drug kind of drinking problem as yeah. well, Wesley Snipes' character. So he's like, he doesn't really care kind of thing.
Yeah, it's such a, like, talking about rediscovering talent too, because mm-hmm. I read somebody in a review, somebody said, like, this is like the most against type that Wesley Snipes has gone since To Wong Fu.
Yeah. And it's a brave kind of, it's almost like a Nicolas Cage type move. It's like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's such a big, like, performance, you know what I mean? It's like,
I got in, yeah, you said that, and it's like, yeah, that there is a Nicolas Cage vibe.
Yeah.
It's like, just like a go for broke, I don't care if this is my last movie ever kind of vibe. And, he's great. And I don't think enough, if Eddie Murphy, if this gets like enough attention that Eddie Murphy gets an Oscar nomination,
I think it might actually get original screenplay nomination as well. I thought the script was just fantastic. Like the way the pressure kind of builds as they're going on, right? He takes over this hotel and that becomes their, like, you know, home right. base. And, you know, and I think the ultimate, one of the kind of more powerful themes of the movie is that, like, the people really accepted and dug the movie and the critics really didn't. And it didn't really matter to Dolomite. It was like the people loving it was the victory.
It makes an interesting statement. I don't know if it goes there, but I was thinking a lot about Tyler Perry and like the work of Tyler Perry, because not to compare Tyler Perry and Rudy Moore, but Tyler Perry is largely inaccessible to a great many in the critical mass, like a lot of the white male film, like they just don't get it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, there's something in Dolomite that speaks to that too, that it's like, you know what, there's been a long tradition in Hollywood where a lot of white guys in dark rooms want to tell black people how they mm-hmm. engage with their own culture and with telling them what they should find funny. And here comes Rudy Moore, who's like, no, like, this is funny. Like, I'm selling records out of the back of my car. It got me a record deal. This speaks to something. Yeah, it's crude, it's crass, but, you know, people are loving it. I have made a career out of this. And, like, so don't tell me what black audiences are going to enjoy. And I think Tyler Perry's done that too. Tyler Perry built his own studio as well. Mm-hmm. You know, he almost had to in order to crank out the things he found funny and the movies he wanted to make. And, you know, so, I mean, there's an odd reflection here that, you know, sometimes things in Hollywood don't change even after 40 years.
Right. Well, maybe there's hope for me then.
No. Maybe there
will
is.
Accept it despite the critics.
Since we don't want to make it all about you, I'm not sure there are a lot of funny lines in the script, and I think it's like structured well. The guys who wrote it, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, these guys are sort of like the master of the biopic. They actually wrote Ed Wood. They wrote Man on the Moon. Mm-hmm. They wrote Big Eyes, which was about the woman who drew the portraits of the people with big eyes. It was a Tim Burton movie a couple of years ago.
I think this is the one that's finally going to get them the Oscar nomination for writing.
Right. It's just, you know, I don't want to harp on it because I did enjoy the movie a lot, but it's like, I realize it's also based on real life too, mm-hmm. but I think that it's not as... The struggle isn't real in it. Like, there's a very, like, you know, kind of Dolomite's going to come up on top and it's all going to work out in the end. And you know, there are a couple of scenes where he has, like, some self-doubt and he struggles. But I never really felt the struggle. And, you know, it's a very up movie. And not that, you know, movies can't be up, but, you know, there's just not a lot of dramatic tension here. It's a very straightforward movie. And I think the performances elevate the script.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like he struggled, like, through the whole thing. Like, his whole life was a struggle. Like, he was, like, the first scene is him trying to, like, get Snoop Dogg, like, who plays a real, like, radio DJ, to get his record on, and Snoop Dogg just kind of turns him down. Like, the first scene, he's being rejected, and it's, like, just, you understand, it's a part of his life, and he still perseveres. So, right. Like, yeah, I was... You know, very I think inspired by it. And even though he, like, he just jumped headfirst into this filmmaking venture and kind of took it on the chin when everyone was saying, no, you don't know what you're doing. Do you even know what you're doing? And, you know, he kind of had to crawl back to the producers and say, I actually need more money for this. And they were like, do you know what you're doing? And he's just taking crap left, right, and center. And it's like, I really did feel the struggle.
I would have liked to have seen more of that is all. It just, you know, I feel like, I don't want to put it this way, but I feel like he wasn't kicked enough for my liking. It's just like, I understand that, you know, you sort of take it on faith at a couple of scenes. Like, he's, like, struggled all his life, and he's, like, been trying to make something of himself. He, like, left Arkansas with, you know, the L.A. dreams
right.
a lot
One
of people had.
One of the recurring themes is that his dad, like, was, you know, a farmer, a poor farmer, and at one point he pulls out the photo and is like, yeah. You know, I kind of made it. Kind of thing.
I loved,
look at me now, Dad, kind of thing.
That was such a great scene.
Yeah.
When he's rehearsing lines for the movie and he's alone in his room and he's rehearsing lines for the movie and then he finds the picture and he starts yelling at his father's picture.
Yeah. Because you don't know what the picture is at first.
Right.
And yeah, it's – so that's also kind of a recurring theme, the rags to riches kind of
I went
further than Dad kind of thing.
I just – I feel like there was just not a lot of dramatic, like the scene you were talking about where he has to go back to the record company guys to get a check to finish the movie. And it's like, it's not very combative. At least for me, I didn't find it particularly combative, and it, you know, it resolves itself by the end. They're like, all right, we're going to give you another check, and like, and I think there might have been something a bit more.
Right, but then the movie can't find a distributor, and he's in the hole again, and then they're at the bar, and he's like, well, it was a fun experience, and he was like, well, it was fun for you, but I'm up to my ears in debt now.
Yeah.
So it's like, I felt like the struggle for money was there. Like, he was always struggling to keep the film alive.
I thought that was another great scene where he kind of, like, yells at him and is like, you know, like, you all are going to pay for your own food today.
Yeah, yeah.
But
Cheesecake. Yeah.
I feel that the script moves, like, boom, 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 boom. It, like, sets up the dominoes and knocks them down. I didn't really feel the dramatic tension. I understood what he was trying to say in those scenes and understood the point it was making, but I didn't quite feel it. And I wish they had just, like, sort of let it drag out a bit. Like let him, like, feel the misery a couple of more scenes. But, you know, I mean, that's a personal taste thing. Like, I have no problem recommending this movie. I think all the cast is great. Like, Snoop Dogg, and he has a small role, but it's like he's the first person you see in the movie other than Eddie Murphy. But it does this weird thing where Snoop Dogg, from the sounds of it, his character has, like, a similar background to Eddie Murphy. He came to L.A. to make music, and now he's working in the record store, too. But he has this, like, weariness on his face and just, like, this tiredness. And it's like, I don't associate that with Snoop Dogg.
Right.
Like, I recognize Snoop Dogg right away, but I don't recognize this like world weariness that he has. It was an interesting you know, thing for Snoop Dogg. I loved Keegan-Michael Key as, like, this.
Oh, that he was so good. He's he's another character I really identified with, right? He's like the acting professor, and he wants to make a serious kind of, like, dramatic statement about trouble in the inner city or something, you know. Like, kind of
it's epitomized in that scene we play where he's like, you know, Rudy, there's, like, we can be dealing with, like, issues affecting our community, you
and
know,
Rudy,
like,
Ray
corruption.
Moore just,
it's like, yes, it's Whitey's fault, but we'll do it with ninjas. It's another one of those things where you can sort of read the broader discussion into it. You know, there are a lot of black filmmakers who want to, you know, talk about their stories and, you know, their fights in the context of, you know, everyday life on the street. And there are ones who just want to entertain.
Yes.
and it's interesting how, you know, at the end, everyone but the Wesley Snipes character can sort of agree that, you know what, they put themselves, like, the things they wanted to do, they were able to put that in this movie. And yeah, it was like this silly movie about a pimp who's released from jail and you know, finds, you know, a new rival, and, you know, with Tommy guns and kung fu, and but, you know, it was also saying some stuff,
right?
Just in like a very unconventional way, and I, you know, there
well,
is
also just bringing attention to a figure that, like, most people aren't familiar with, but
absolutely,
who is probably important. Like, obviously that decade was very important for kind of blaxploitation kind of cinema and all of that stuff, you know what I mean? Rudy Ray Moore could be argued was, like, kind of some of the genesis of that. So yeah, I think it's kind of an important piece of history in some ways.
Yes.
An interesting piece of history anyway.
And I think, like, since we experience a lot of history through movies, it's, you know, telling these stories is very, very important. And it's on Netflix now. It's one of those things I do wish, like, maybe it was in theaters.
Yeah.
speaking of the earlier debate, but it is accessible to everyone who has a Netflix account, and it's very much worth watching.
It's one of my favorite movies of the year. You'll probably see it in my top five at the end of the year.
I think this has been, like, a really good year for, you know, biopics of, like, you know, or, you know, sort of like realizing old Hollywood, and I think you can say that about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well. And I think there's one from way earlier this year, the Stan and Ollie biopic about Laurel and Hardy that was really, really good too. It didn't like break the art form like, you know, this one, it plays very much close to the as you said, the Roger Ebert quote. It does mm-hmm. what it does very, very well, but they were still, like, really great movies with really great performances at the heart. And
it's just, like, as a struggling filmmaker, how could I not totally not love identify this with movie? Another struggling, like, filmmaker? Yeah.
Speaking of struggling filmmaker,
yes,
your film is being shown
yes.
next month.
So, you know, probably a couple of years ago, we shot a scene from that film in this very studio.
That's right.
And so I have to thank you for your contribution. It's
oh,
wonderful. It's one of the comments that people always give me is, like, the radio host was very funny. But yes, you've been accepted into this Video Drunk Film Festival in Toronto. So that'll be happening on November 28th, I believe. It's the first time I've ever experienced this. It's the first film I've ever made, so we'll see how it goes. But I believe Tim has gotten a film accepted into that festival before too, so should yeah. be a good time.
All right. Well, where can people find more information about that?
You can probably just go on Facebook, type in Video Drunk. They okay. have their own page. Even if you want to Google that, they've got their own kind of webpage type thing. Yeah.
All right. Well, that gives the people something to look up aside from our own website, endcreditsradioshow.com. If you want to listen to the episode again, it is on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. We're on social media on Facebook at Endcredits Radio Show and on Twitter at Endcredits Radio. And Tim, where I called you Tim. Vince, where else can people find you on the internet? it's the end of the show.
Yes. You can't really. I've deactivated all social media.
Oh, wow. That's bold.
Yeah.
So find Video Drunk. And
Video Drunk, yes. And we'll be in touch through that.
All right. And I will be back here on CFRU on Thursday, tomorrow at 5 p.m. for
yes,
News
Tim,
and Politics.
Where can we find you?
Thank you. Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.ca and stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more Tim Credits, and we'll see you then.